Coming up on Tech News Weekly, we have two great interviews planned for you. First, Jason Howell speaks to Patience Hagen of the Wall Street Journal about Google's ad business and the Wall Street Journal investigation that looked into how they may not be holding up to their terms of service and might owe a lot of money. Then Hugh Langley of Business Insider stops by to talk about Google killing off its Iris augmented reality smart glasses and how they may shift to focusing on software for other companies' hardware. Then we've got our stories of the week. First, a look at the Secret Invasion AI-generated intro. Jason and I both talk about how that's maybe a good thing, maybe a bad thing, and the outrage therein before we round things out with Sony revealing, well, not really revealing itself, but having its secrets revealed in a case involving Microsoft and the FTC. Stay tuned for this episode of Tech News Weekly.
Podcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is TWiT.
This is Tech News Weekly, episode 292, recorded Thursday, June 29th, 2023. The Ashes of Google Iris. This episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Duo. Duo protects against breaches with a leading access management suite, providing strong multi-layered defenses to only allow legitimate users in. For any organization concerned about being breached and needs a solution fast, Duo quickly enables strong security and improves user productivity. Visit cs.co/twit today for a free trial.
And by Drata. Security professionals often undergo manual tasks of collecting evidence. With Drata, companies can complete audits, monitor controls, and expand security assurance efforts to scale. Say goodbye to manual evidence collection and hello to automation, all done at Drata speed. Visit drata.com/twit to get a demo and 10% off implementation.
Listeners of this program get an ad-free version if they're members of Club Twit. $7 a month gives you ad-free versions of all of our shows, plus membership in the Club Twit Discord, a great clubhouse for Twit listeners. And finally, the Twit Plus feed with shows like Stacey's Book Club, The Untitled Linux Show, The Giz Fizz, and more. Go to twit.tv/clubtwit, and thanks for your support.
Hello and welcome to Tech News Weekly, the show where every week we talk to and about the people making and breaking the tech news. I am one of your hosts, Micah Sargent.
I'm the other guy, Jason Howell. I'm realizing we've got a similar like white kind of shirt color, but I forgot the memo on the like dressing up. Like I'm super casual, and I guess you're casual, but it's a dressed up casual.
Yeah,
so I think I need to step up my
casual
game. Yeah. Anyways, you're looking super sharp. Oh, I wish I was looking a little bit sharper. Nonetheless, let's dive into the actual reason that we are here, which is technology news. And we've got a couple of great interviews for you and some awesome stories of the week later. Let's start with Google's ad business under increasing scrutiny in, I'd say, the last few years, especially. Now, new research showing that Google hasn't been doing a very good job of following its own agreed to standards for ads that are playing on third-party sites, and a whole lot more. Joining me to walk through the claims made in the report that we're going to be talking about today is Patience Hagen, who wrote about this story for the Wall Street Journal. Welcome to the show, Patience. We appreciate you.
Thank you so much for having me on.
Absolutely. It's great to get you here. So let's maybe set the stage a little bit. Tell us a little bit about what kinds of ads. Well, first of all, what is this report? Who did it? And what kinds of ads are they focused on? You know, Google apparently made some promises here and they're not following through. What are those promises?
This report focused on a particular kind of ad that's sold along with YouTube ads. YouTube's owned by Google, and Google sells these bundles that include both ads on YouTube and video ads that run on third-party sites. But as part of the bundle, they're promised that the ads on those sites will run in an environment similar to videos on YouTube. And so it comes with a bunch of promises that they run on like premium sites, that these ads only appear before the page's main video content, and the ads are skippable, and that they'll be audible. Those are some of the promises. And I wrote about a report that found that in many cases, those promises are not kept. And these ads that advertisers paid a premium price for are actually running on sites that violate a lot of those standards.
Well, in the report, like the number of, I don't know if you call them infractions or number of incidences that were discovered is super high. This isn't just like a small amount. I think it was somewhere in the 80% range. When you say videos similar to video or ads similar to videos on YouTube, is it that like is it the fact that they like play audio up, or what exactly makes them similar to what you find on YouTube and the YouTube experience?
It's audio up, and one of the most important characteristics is that it's on the page's main content. Like, it's not in some video player that's off to the side that the user doesn't want to see. It's supposed to be on content that the user came to that page to watch and initiated watching. And the ad is supposed to be skippable, so users have the right to skip it if they choose. And what this researcher found over and over again is that, you know, in 80% of cases, one of those promises wasn't kept. 80%. Very often, it was playing in a player that was like off to the side of the page, probably where the user would never look, not on top of the content that they came there to watch.
Wow. So I guess what strikes me about this is, you know, we run a podcast network here. We work with sponsors and advertisers, and we know firsthand that sponsors and advertisers are very aware of how their ads are being done. They're very interested in it, right? If they're paying money for these ads, they want to know that things are happening the right way. Has any of this been talked about prior to this? Like any advertisers with YouTube and Google that have noticed and reported this ahead of this report? Because 80% seems like a lot to go unnoticed until now, I guess, is my point.
Yeah, you're absolutely right. And this kind of error hadn't been found before. No one had really scrutinized these ad buys in such a comprehensive way as this researcher did. He examined tens of millions of them and found that they violated standards 80% of the time. Of course, over the years, Google has had numerous incidents where buyers found flaws in how their ads were being placed. For instance, like they bought ads on YouTube, but they were running on controversial YouTube channels, or the ads were running on controversial sites.
Yeah.
But what makes this report kind of a big sea change from that is the fact that it appears to be so systemic, and that this happened on probably Google's most expensive, most premium ad product. You know, people are paying for the most premium type of ad, and they're getting kind of a cheap, that low value ad that they would pay a lot less for.
Yeah, no kidding. Now, you also report that the journal also spotted similar activity. What can you share about those findings? Like, how did the journal go in to kind of verify some of this stuff, and what exactly did you find?
I visited sites that were part of Google's network for these ads, Google Video Partners, and I was able to replicate the same error. I was able to see that the ads were running in players that violated the standards, and I was able to verify that they were ads purchased through the same program by examining the code.
Okay.
I was able to kind of independently confirm the phenomenon and see that high value ads were running in low value placements.
Yeah, just it blows my mind that this wasn't obvious prior to. It seems like a pretty obvious thing to spot, and especially on the side of the advertiser. But here we are. Was there any confusion like on the way that Google is spelling out kind of what it is promising? I mean, how is Google responding to this, or you know, YouTube, as far as these specific claims in this report are concerned? How are they reacting to that?
They called the report inaccurate, and they said that they weren't too specific about which of the findings were inaccurate, but they suggested that the sampling was wrong. They think that maybe that 80% stat is wrong, but they didn't deny, they didn't deny the specifics of it. They didn't deny that these premium ads are running in low value spots. Mm-hmm. They didn't say specifically which claims they considered inaccurate. And Google's been taking calls from a lot of advertisers the past few days who are demanding answers about it. When it comes to like, did brands know where their ads were going to run? That's one thing I learned while I was reporting this story, that many of the brands who buy these ads don't necessarily realize they're not all going to run on YouTube. Since it's sold as part of a bundle. Yeah, it's sold as part of a bundle with YouTube ads. And advertisers actually, in most cases, they have the chance to opt out of having these ads run on third-party sites, but they usually don't. And many of the buyers buying them didn't even realize that it was a bundle, that it wasn't just exclusively YouTube ads. And in sales pitches for this product, Google doesn't really emphasize the third-party sites. They just emphasize it as a YouTube product.
And yet, it sounds like so many of these are ending up on the third-party sites and not YouTube, the kind of the premium product. So you mentioned that advertisers are kind of reaching out to Google. That was certainly a question that I had. How are they responding? Like, when a report like this happens, and especially as like a very like condemning report, 80% is no small number. Like, what is the influence or the power that a report like this could have on Google going forward? I mean, is it just that advertisers respond, Google makes changes, or could it be something more significant, something on like a federal level getting involved? Where are we at right now?
Well, it's definitely gotten the interest of some in federal government. You know, interestingly enough, the ad campaigns that were affected by this included a number of political ad campaigns, like for senators and other politicians. So these findings have been very much of interest to senators like Mike Lee and other senators who have found out that their own ads their own ad buys were violating standards this way. So we're already hearing from senators and other government agencies who are really interested in this. You know, at the very least, they might be joining the chorus of advertisers who are demanding information and potentially demanding refunds. If this adds to any of the pending investigations into Google, that could add yet another wrinkle. It's giving people another reason to question whether Google's just gotten too big and whether Google's too powerful when it comes to the online ad market.
Yeah, I think that's what makes this particularly compelling at this moment, is that there is this big wave of attention placed on companies like Google to really look into the business that they're doing, that largely many people have just taken for granted over the years, and like, oh yeah, that's how they do business. I mean, it's a big, you know, it's a big thing and it's a big company and whatever. And then now that attention has really shifted. So a report like this could really feed into that sentiment and impact things. I know certainly in the EU, you know, they're probably watching this pretty closely, but also in the US and other markets. It seems kind of like the ripe time for something like this, if someone has that as a goal in mind, to really crack down on what big tech is doing. Well, this is fascinating stuff. We're certainly going to continue watching this, because I think this, you know, we continue to talk about this topic on the show because so much is happening right now in the face of regulation around companies like Google. So we'll certainly follow along. And Patience, I want to thank you for joining us to talk about your work on reporting on this report, as well as kind of doing your own investigation on a deeper level. Patience Hagen writes for The Wall Street Journal, WSJ.com. If people want to follow you online, where can they find you, Patience?
On my Twitter, Patience Hagen.
Right on. Excellent. Thank you so much, Patience. We'll talk to you soon. Take care. All right. Coming up next, I'm super interested in this, Google's AR strategy and how it's shifted over the years, continues to unfold in predictably Google fashion, I think, right now.
Yeah,
it's kind of like, oh, here we go again. So buckle up. We're going to get to that in a moment. First, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Duo. Duo protects against breaches with a leading access management suite. It's strong, multi-layered defenses and innovative capabilities that only allow legitimate users in and as well keep the bad actors out. That's what you really want, right? For any organization concerned about being breached that needs protection fast, Duo quickly enables strong security while also improving user productivity. Duo prevents unauthorized access with multi-layered defenses and modern capabilities that thwart sophisticated malicious access attempts. Increased authentication requirements in real time when risk rises. That's a nice benefit. Duo actually enables high productivity by only requiring authentication when needed. That enables swift, easy, and secure access. Duo provides an all-in-one solution for strong MFA, passwordless, single sign-on, and trusted endpoint verification. Duo actually helps you implement zero trust principles by verifying users and their devices. What it's all about. You got to verify they are who they say they are and that those devices belong. Start your free trial and sign up today. All you have to do is go to cs.co/twit. That's cs.co/twit. And we thank Duo for their support of Tech News Weekly. All right, Micah.
All right. So, yes, in typical Google fashion, we have heard about a upcoming sunsetting, potentially a cancellation, a killing, an ending, a shuttering. There are a number of verbs we could use to describe Google's plans with its AR, mixed reality, VR, hardware. Joining us today to talk about what's going on is Hugh Langley, who, writing for Business Insider, has an inside look at what may have happened to Google's Iris. Mm-hmm. Welcome to the show, Hugh.
Hey, guys. Thanks for having me.
Yeah, it's a pleasure. So I think it's important that we start with the basics. I was hoping you could first tell us about Google's Iris smart glasses. Before this most recent news about the cancellation, what had Google planned to offer leading up to this point? And how did that project compare to the now infamous Google Glass?
Yeah, so Project Iris is a kind of code name for a series of devices they were working on, but fundamentally all the same idea that they would be smart glasses. And to your point about Google Glass, you know, I think Google Glass, we all agree, looked a little bit weird. It didn't look like actual glasses. And what they wanted to do was kind of create something that looked a bit more like a regular pair of spectacles. So Iris was the plan to do that. It was going to be using augmented reality technology. So you would see projections on the glass. The project itself ran through various iterations. They took several attempts at building a kind of pair of smart glasses, and it didn't work out. And not too long ago, they decided to shelve it, for the time being at least.
Now, when you say they decided to shelve it, it's my understanding that Insider, that you sort of have more knowledge about this, because I'm pointing out just yesterday, or maybe it was even this morning, I saw a bunch of different articles talking about this, but you at least have sources familiar with the matter, correct?
Yeah, that's right. So I know some certain people inside the company, some who's still there and some who have left, who were close to the project. It's been running for, I mean, maybe more than a year now. They've been working on Iris from sort of late 2021, maybe, to sort of early 2022. It started really getting off the ground. They shored up a lot of talent. They they acquired a Canadian startup named North. They made a pair of smart glasses themselves called the Focals. I don't know, you guys may have used them. They created a little bit of buzz at the time, and Google bought them effectively to shore up these AR efforts. And another AR company as well called Raxium. So they really kind of went, they got pretty serious about this for a while at least. Yeah. And they took several, you know, like I said, the project itself went through several iterations. Ultimately, the technology was just proving too difficult for them to make something out of. You know, they wanted to turn this into a consumer product, but it was just too difficult. They took too many pivots, and then they just decided to kill it.
Yeah. So you're kind of describing there my next question, which I'm kind of curious what, as far as you know, led to the cancellation of the project. And I know some people are out there, they're going to be wondering, did Google's decision to kill Iris have anything to do with Apple's newly announced Apple Vision Pro headset? Because we saw Facebook or Meta preemptively announce its next headset right before Apple went on stage and announced theirs. So you see in this space in particular, a lot of companies reacting to the news of this new sort of ultra premium headset. Why is Google getting out of the game? And does any of it, in your opinion, or from what you've learned, have anything to do with that Vision Pro?
Yeah, so inevitably, you know, all companies look into what Apple's doing. There was certainly fear inside Google for the last year or longer even that, you know, Apple's cooking something up really good. So there's another product that Google is working on in tandem and has been working on, which it actually announced earlier this year. It's a partner product with Samsung. So Samsung's actually going to build it and Google's going to offer the software, but it's going to be a kind of, they're calling it XR goggles. And I think from what I've heard, that's going to be a little more aligned with what Apple's doing with the Vision Pro. Mm-hmm. While Iris was a pure augmented reality on a very sort of spelt pair of smart glasses, which is, you know, that presents a lot of technological hurdles. So to answer your question about why they kind of killed it, you know, they were really struggling with the technology for a long time. There was a lot of pivots with what it should do. I don't know if you guys remember, but last year at Google I/O, they actually showed off a pair of glasses running a translation feature in a kind of a cool demo. That was actually Iris. They didn't say it, but that was a version of Iris they were working on. So they had these really interesting ideas, but they just couldn't make it stick. I think they pivoted a couple of times after that. Then earlier this year, Clay Baver, who was leading their VR and AR efforts for many years, left the company. They did layoffs at the company. They reshuffled a bunch of teams. And then after that, I'm told it just kind of petered out.
Oh, wow. Okay. Yeah. That would lead to the cancellation for sure. Now, you did mention that Google was working on a ski goggle style mixed reality product. And I think originally we thought that people who were paying attention to this thought that Google was making it internally, but now we know that this is something that is from Samsung. Did Samsung already announce this headset goggle deal, or is this still kind of something that's under wraps, but people are just aware of?
Google and Samsung did a press conference earlier this year, I think right at the start of February, if I remember correctly. And they announced this partnership that they were working on this product, but they really didn't reveal very much. They talked a little bit more about it at I/O, but it's pretty under wraps right now. In terms of what was happening in Google, there was a kind of prototyping project that's been going on for a long time, maybe a year or a bit longer than that, that became the kind of foundation of what this was. But ultimately Google made the decision that its strength was in software, and it felt like making a software play was smarter. So in terms of the Samsung headset, Google will be providing an Android kind of software experience to that. Samsung will be building the headset itself, and I believe Qualcomm is providing the chips. Mm. So that's kind of what this, to tie this to the Iris stuff as well, this is kind of Google's, you know, when they kind of killed Iris, the change in thinking was we need to be a software player in this. Now that may change down the road, but I think, you know, they want to be in on this game. No one wants to be out. You've just talked about what Apple's doing. You know, this is, you know, Meta are reportedly working on, you know, they've got other headsets, but also glasses. You know, no one wants to be left out here. So Google needs to play in it. And I think they see themselves as being a kind of Android for AR, XR, is a smarter play, at least for now. And then we'll see what happens.
So that almost falls in line with what Google does at this moment, where any, you know, company can make the hardware and sort of make use of the Android platform. Given that understanding, do you have any insight into if it will look like the Android marketplace looks now in terms of, if I'm Samsung, I'm running Android on my device, but I'm adding all of these customizations. And if I'm, one of the other players, OnePlus, then I'm, you know, running the, I think they're Oxygen OS or whatever. Any insight into if it's going to be like a pure mixed reality Android experience on these third party hardware platforms, or if it's going to be kind of, because I think of what Microsoft does with Windows, where, you know, there's lots of different hardware, but they're all running Windows 10, Windows, whatever it happens to be at this point, more like that, or how things are as it stands.
Yeah, it's early days and it's hard to say. Google itself has not said much either publicly. What I do know from chatting to people at the company is this isn't just Samsung they're interested. They are making a play to be a platform provider for anyone who will be a partner to them. So similar to Android, right? So they made this big splashy announcement with Samsung. That makes sense. Samsung's obviously a legacy partner for Google. They have history even in the VR space as well. I think, you know, it's hard to say, but I will say I know that Google wants this to be a platform that anyone can kind of jump aboard with. And that's the one they're working on at the moment for these XR goggles as well, which I reported in the story this week, that they are still working on a sort of more lightweight version of that for companies that want to build something more like Iris, something more like those kind of slimmer down glasses. So they're trying to really hedge their bets a little bit. You know, it's hard to say how this market's going to play out. We do know Apple is also working on AR glasses that were more like Iris. They are, according to some great reporting from Bloomberg, struggling with the technology there as well. It's very hard to get this technology shrunk down. We also know from some information, from reporting from the information, that Meta is also very kind of deep into work on these glasses as well, and may even seed a version of these to developers as soon as next year. There's the heads, the mixed reality experience, which we saw Apple kind of come out the gate with, very compelling idea. But there's also a belief among the companies still that there will be a desire for something that's maybe a bit more lightweight, maybe a bit more pure augmented reality. So Google is, as far as last I heard, sort of playing to both of those at the moment.
Yeah, and then I guess the last question is, did they put Iris and the hardware prototypes into the incinerator, or it's gone forever, or is it stashed away in a nitrogen vault somewhere where it eventually, essentially what I'm asking is, could we see the return of this Iris hardware somewhere down the line based on, you know, your understanding of how done this project is?
Yeah, no, you're absolutely right. There is a vault of sorts. I'm not sure if nitrogen's involved, but it's certainly Google is known to kind of shelve things and put them on ice. There's absolutely a chance Iris could come back. And what I do know from speaking to people inside the company is some teams were reshuffled into other parts of their hardware division and are still exploring AR technologies. So, you know, from the ashes of Iris could come another Iris or something similar. They certainly, like I said previously, they know this is a space that is heating up. So Iris is toast. But I do think, you know, they still got some of the best brains, in this area, in the AR, XR, VR space, whatever you want to call it. So if they can hold on to that talent, then who knows? So I wouldn't say it's done. You know, Google could resurrect this idea down the line, but I think for now they just see themselves as being the platform rather than the headset maker at this stage, at least for the glasses.
Yeah. You know, honestly, now I just want to plan a heist to get Google Reader out of the vault. So I'm working on that. But no, thank you so much for your time today. Of course, folks should head over to businessinsider.com to read this excellent reporting. But if folks want to follow you online and make sure they're staying up with what you've got, is there a place or a few places they should go to do that?
Yeah, best place is probably follow me on Twitter, just at Hugh Langley. All one word, pretty easy. That's probably the place you'll see me share most of my stories.
Awesome. Well, thank you so much. We appreciate it.
Thanks so much, guys.
Before you go any further, Google Reader killed 10 years ago. Oh, so it's now a decade.
It's a decade?
You lived a decade without Google Reader at this point.
I don't know how I've made it this far.
I don't know how any of us have.
Goodbye, Google Reader. I love you. Up next, we're going to get to our stories of the week. But first, this episode of Tech News Weekly is brought to you by Drata. I have a question. Is your organization finding it difficult to collect manual evidence and achieve continuous compliance as it grows and scales? As a leader in cloud compliance software by G2, Drata streamlines your SOC 2, ISO 27001, PCI DSS, GDPR, HIPAA, and other compliance frameworks, providing 24-hour continuous control monitoring so you can focus on scaling securely. With a suite of more than 75 integrations, Drata easily integrates through applications such as AWS, Azure, GitHub, Okta, and Cloudflare, and countless security professionals from companies including Lemonade, Notion, and Bamboo HR have shared how crucial it has been to have Drata as a trusted partner in the compliance process. You can expand security assurance efforts using the Drata platform, which allows companies to see all of their controls and easily map them to compliance frameworks to gain immediate insight into framework overlap. Drata's automated dynamic policy templates support companies new to compliance using integrated security awareness training programs and automated reminders to ensure smooth employee onboarding. As the only player in the industry to build on a private database architecture, your data can never be accessed by anyone outside your organization. All customers receive a team of compliance experts, including a designated customer success manager, and Drata's team of former auditors has conducted more than 500 audits. Your Drata team keeps you on track to ensure that there are no surprises or barriers. Plus, Drata's pre-audit calls prepare you for when your audits begin. I love that sort of gathering around the table and going, all right, let's plan this. We're going to get this figured out. Everybody, it's fine. Drata's Audit Hub is the solution to faster, more efficient audits. You can save hours of back and forth communication, never misplace crucial evidence, and share documentation instantly. All interactions and data gathering can occur in Drata between you and your auditor, so you won't have to switch between different tools or correspondence strategies. With Drata's risk management solution, you can manage end-to-end risk assessment and treatment workflows. Flag risks, score them, and then decide whether to accept, mitigate, transfer, or avoid them. Drata maps appropriate controls to risks, simplifying risk management and automating the process. Drata's Trust Center provides real-time transparency into security and compliance posture, which improves sales, security reviews, and better relationships with customers and partners. Say goodbye, bye-bye, to manual evidence collection and hello to automated compliance by visiting drata.com/twit. That's drata.com/twit. Bringing automation to compliance at Drata speed. And we thank Drata for sponsoring this week's episode of Tech News Weekly. You know, I saw a tweet just yesterday, and it was somebody who was their son was babysitting, you know, a little kid. So say the kid was like 8, 9 years old.
Yeah.
And they were playing music from like an Echo or something. And the Echo, the song You Can Call Me Al came up, and the little kid, you ready to feel very old? The little kid said, why does he want us to call him AI? Yeah.
Interesting. Sign of the times. Mm-hmm. I love it. Also, by the way, I just looked it up. Google Reader killed July 1st, 2013. So literally 2 days from now, goodness. It's the 10 year anniversary.
I'll have to pour one out.
That's right. That's right. There you go. All right. We can all be a little sad on that day, I suppose. Right from the jump, I will just fully admit I'm not really a comic book guy. I realize on a network where I'm surrounded by people who are comic book people, that's maybe a little dangerous to admit, but you know, it's just was nothing that I was really into when I was a kid, and that didn't really translate into my adulthood and everything. So on the surface, a story about a new Disney Plus Marvel show. Mm-hmm. It's called Secret Invasion. It wouldn't normally like captivate me or grab my attention, but then generative AI got involved. Uh-huh. And now I'm really interested in the story. So last week, this new show called Secret Invasion launched its first episode on Disney Plus. I actually have to say that the plot sounds interesting to me. It's a story of this like in slow motion invasion of Earth by shape-shifting aliens that you don't know that they're there, but they are kind of actually, what was that 80s horror movie? They Live. That's right.
They Live
was a similar plot point there too. Great movie, by the way. I'm guessing there's lots of Marvel action. I'm guessing there's lots of superhero stuff in there, and I'm sure it's all great. But it came out of the gate with a little bit of controversy because the opening title sequence, have you seen the opening title sequence
I've
of this?
I've seen pieces of it. I'm also of it.
I was wondering if we could show it, but is it. And so I apologize for audio listeners, but video listeners, you should definitely go online, find the trailer for it. And if you've been following generative AI at all and kind of the progression of this as related to art and animation and everything, you're going to recognize it immediately. Like it really does. Either they were trying to make it look like generative AI animation, mm-hmm. or they actually used generative AI to do this. So, it has this title sequence, obviously has generative AI as the, kind of the DNA, regardless of how it was done. People started to really notice this, right? And you know, when you're watching the intro, I think what a lot of people jump to is, okay, wait a minute, this is a Marvel property. Mm-hmm. This is usually employed by teams of people to create motion graphics for, you know, these things. In historically speaking, this is the way it's been. And yet here we are, this major property being generated by AI. Oh no, you know, it's the story of they're taking our jobs, mm-hmm. essentially is what it is. People,
which is kind of the plot of the show too. Oh, right?
Well,
they're taking over.
That's an interesting kind of correlation between the two. Mm-hmm. I actually wonder if there's any
if somebody was being clever about it,
kind of connection there, as far as making a statement or of about it or whatever. Many people were concerned that this high profile studio property was utilizing generative AI instead of relying on its artists.
Right in the middle of a strike.
Right in the middle. Yeah, right. So Hollywood's not in a great spot to begin with. And then this launches. Let's see here. So it's driven by that fear of like AI is going to come in. It's going to change everything, put people out of jobs, make the rich even richer. All that kind of stuff, I think, is what people have responded to, right? Method Studios provided a statement to the Hollywood Reporter, mm-hmm. that read, and I'll quote, AI is just one tool among the array of tool sets our artists used. No artists' jobs were replaced by incorporating these new tools. Instead, they complemented and assisted our creative teams. So that, the entire opening relied upon traditional work of the art department in their interpretation, did utilize some of the existing custom AI tools to create parts of the characters, the movements shown in the intro, but still required the designers to be involved. It's not just like, create me an intro to a Marvel show.
Yeah, it wasn't the director going and sitting down at the computer and saying.
And in fact, I'm happy you mentioned that, because director Ali Salem, I hope I'm pronouncing his last name correctly, talked about this process. And I thought it was kind of adorable, actually, the way he talks about it. But I think it's also kind of representative of how vague some people's understanding or knowledge about the process of generative AI actually is. He said, quote, we would talk to them about ideas and themes and words, and then the computer would go off and do something. And then we could change it a little bit by using words, and it would change.
Oh,
I just thought that was, like I said, it was just kind of adorable that the director of this project was speaking kind of like a child would talk about generative AI. Anyways, I think for me, this was interesting because it really comes around to a few things primarily. One, do we believe them at their word? If they're saying that this was AI used in concert with its artists to create something new and fresh and timely, like I believe them at their word as far as that's concerned. I feel like we would have heard from designers maybe, and maybe I'm missing it somewhere out in internet land, that designers who felt like they were harmed by this, like, would we hear from them? Even as like designers close to, or what would they say? Familiar with the matter. Yeah, designers familiar with the matter, right? Yeah. But I don't feel like we're hearing that.
So I haven't seen anything yet.
Yeah.
But what I feel like happened here is that the people, because you gather this is not something that just came out yesterday, or, you know, this is something that's been in the works for quite a long time.
Sure.
And you gather your team and you, the people, the producers, the folks who are making this, they're going through a process that is almost always kind of, at the very least, it's templatized, right? It doesn't all happen to be locked in place.
But right.
There's a standard process that you tend to follow. Mm-hmm. So they gather the teams, they gather the VFX artists that they want to work with, that they've worked with before. And it probably was like in later on down the line in a pitch meeting, someone said, oh, you know what we could do is use generative AI as part of this thing because it'll give that, you know,
it's very current.
It's very current. And then we'll be able to, you know, sort of put that out there in the press that this is part of it. And it's just, it all, yeah, it's like any company that wants to suddenly say, we're using generative AI too.
Yeah.
I don't think the concern should be on this and that it was taking people's jobs. I think we have to look at the next 5-10 years where up to this point it's been templatized, but the next group that is looking for how they're going to create their intro, that at that point there could be jobs lost. You know what I mean? Mm. I don't see this company, especially Marvel, especially Disney, going, well, we can just do it with this, so we're going to fire this team that we've already lined up to do this.
Right, right.
I'm sure it was that team that was lined up to do this that decided to use generative AI as part of their process.
Yeah.
But in the next 5 years, will then those producers go, oh, you know, we've got to redo this part, but we don't need to hire that VFX company that we've used in the past. We can just have one of our in-house VFX artists have the help of AI to pull this off or something like that. So I think if the focus of the anger is on the loss of jobs here, then in everything that I'm seeing and everything that I understand, that's misplaced. But a general concern about how that could impact future jobs, I think is fair.
Yeah. I think it's worth exploring.
Absolutely.
At the same time, how much do you dial back now to protect something that has not happened and might not happen? You know what I mean?
Yeah.
And I think, you know, Jeff Jarvis on This Week in Google has talked about this in recent weeks, and he has a name for it. What is it? It's something about, there's a particular, in the realm of AI, and I know I wrote it down somewhere, but it's in buried in a million different notes. There is this kind of like general kind of understanding among, like, let's just say AI bros, where everything is hyper focused around now doesn't matter. It's then that matters most. And so even if we have to sacrifice now for the good of later, that's the right approach. And so I see some similarities between these things, like what you're talking about, and that they're obviously coming from different perspectives. But how deeply do we now concern and shut off the spigot on things like this when we don't know where it leads?
And I almost feel like that's not realistic anyway.
No. Like, I totally agree.
I hate to be the negative Nelson here about it, but. Or even the cynical Cindy about it. But the fact is, the AI cat is out of the AI box, and AI Schrodinger has already made the decision.
Right.
You know, like, we can be upset about it, but here's, again, the cynical Cindy is the fact that, is our griping really going to make a difference?
Yeah. What does it lead to? Long-termism is the term.
Long-termism.
And if you hear him talking about long-termism, that's kind of the idea behind it, is that the sacrifices we make now, be it people's safety, you know, all these different things.
For the sake of
the future. Right. Exactly. Like the pain that we're experiencing now doesn't matter because it saves lives then.
You know, or what's a shame that sort about of that is... that is an incredibly difficult thing to get humans to do, is to think about helping out the future, because we, by our very nature of thousands and thousands of years, have been so focused on not only the now, but ourselves.
How do you even change that? Yeah.
It's kind of wild that there is a group that's using that as a focus for something like AI. If instead we had that focus on climate change.
Oh, totally. Right.
Like, if we could sacrifice now for the sake of the future in that way, it would change everything.
Yeah,
but instead it's like the oddest things that we choose to go.
Totally.
Well, it doesn't matter if it impacts people now, cause we're trying to help. Yeah.
Right.
Come on.
Anyway, right.
That's an aside.
It is interesting though.
Long-termism.
Yeah. I need to set aside some time and look into it and research it. I spoke with Jeff Jarvis yesterday about, I'm working on an AI show for launching in the club here in sometime in the near future, and probably going to be doing that with Jeff Jarvis. He's very interested in getting on board. But we were talking about this whole thing yesterday morning, and he brought that up as something that he's been doing a lot of research, and how there's a lot of there's overlap in like the AI bro contingency and this idea of long-termism, that now sacrifice for now doesn't matter as much as what we get to down the line. So there's some relation, some correlation there, but yeah. So anyways, interesting story, a kind of interesting moment when it comes to generative AI, because this was bound to happen eventually, that some major studio would use this technology in this way. And they, of course, had to know that once that intro went public, certain people were going to notice. Certain people are going to feel very negatively about it.
Right.
And have their talking points in place and everything like that, you know. I think where we're at right now, it really seems like, you know, this is like Photoshop. I'm a professional Photoshop user, and suddenly a new feature has been implemented into Photoshop that allows me to do the thing that I've done before, but a lot easier. Mm-hmm. And I don't think that we generally bat an eye to that. We're like, oh, wow, great feature.
Right.
You know, right. That's awesome. That saves me time, instead of, oh, that's horrible. That feature is going to put me out of a job. And I just don't, right now, it's hard for me to see how that AI thing puts people out of a job. I think they just learn to use it as another tool in their tool set. That's what I hope for anyways.
The device that made that automatically wove fibers together, the automated sewing machine, computer. I mean, over the history of humanity, we have made tools that help speed up different processes in our lives, and humans have always adapted to those things.
Right.
So I think we'll continue to do that. I hope that we'll continue.
Yeah, I'm hopeful that we will. And I think I'm optimistic that we will, I think is where I land on that. By the way, Method Studio earned an Oscar nod in January for its visual effects on Top Gun Maverick.
Oh, I thought you were going to say, but yeah, that would have been too soon. I was thinking for this, but yeah, that was.
We'll see. Yeah. That would be another kind of milestone moment, right?
Who gets the award?
Yes.
Is it the monkey who took the photograph, or is it?
I would like to thank the studio.
Oh,
yeah.
Golly.
Oh, boy. Sorry for my horrible, stereotypical robot impersonation. I apologize. All right. What's your story of the week?
My story of the week is all about redaction. So I'm only going to say every three words.
Oh, boy.
Sorry. Good luck. No, I'm kidding. I will say all of the words that are going to come out of my mouth. So Sony, while they're not at the center of the disagreement between the sort of United States and other governments. They're not at the center of the disagreement between the United States and other governments, and then Microsoft. They do play a role in the FTC facing off against Microsoft and, you know, the other bodies around the world that are facing off against Microsoft, because as we know, Microsoft is working to acquire Activision Blizzard. Mm-hmm. And some are saying that if they acquire Activision Blizzard, it's going to greatly reduce competition in the market. And by greatly reducing competition in the market, then that's going to obviously result in a monopoly of sorts. Microsoft holds that absolutely it's not going to, as you might imagine. And so as part of these hearings, there's obviously evidence presented to try and come up with a with why or why not that is the case. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. So Sony has information that was provided as part of the hearings, the ongoing hearings. And this information is redacted. However,
redacted light, L-I-T-E.
Yes. So The Verge calls it a Sharpie. It says the headline is Sony's confidential PlayStation secrets just spilled because of a Sharpie. I'm not comfortable calling it a Sharpie.
I'm not either. I'm happy you point this out. I don't think it's a Sharpie. That does not look like a Sharpie. Yeah,
the way that the lines are so perfect.
They're perfect. They're
too perfect. The edges are perfect.
Totally.
I don't know that it's a Sharpie. It could very well be that it's printed out and then somehow like redacted over it in an automated process. I don't know what's going on, but whatever the redaction process is, and it looks almost like I've done this before where in a PDF, if depending on which tool you use to redact, the text is still underneath with the redaction over the top of it. So if you're using something like a laser printer, which instead of putting down ink that soaks into the paper, essentially puts a layer on top of the paper, then the text will still, the little dots of the text end up underneath. And by little dots, I mean, that's kind of how a laser printer works, is that it's these tiny, tiny, tiny little micro dots that sort of adhere to the page. And then the redaction goes over the top of it. So you have kind of a raised area. Now, again, I'm not sure how they did this. The point is, regardless of how it's being done, you can kind of, in some cases, read the text beneath the redaction.
Heck yes, you can.
And it reveals quite a bit about Sony and kind of their confidential information regarding the PlayStation. First and foremost, they have some information about Horizon Forbidden West, which cost Sony $212 million over 5 years. And had, or I should say, it cost the group that made it $212 million, not $212, over 5 years with a group of 300 employees. Then The Last of Us Part Two cost $220 million and around 200 employees. But this is even more interesting. And I'm going to read from this sort of pull quote in The Verge. In 2021, over 14 million users, and the little accent there that I'm saying is because they're not exactly sure if it says 14 or 15 or 6. It could say another number, but they think it's 14. So if you hear me do that sort of upspeak there, it's because there's a question mark. So in 2021, over 14 million users by device spent 30% or more of their time playing Call of Duty. Over 6 million users spent more than 70% of their time on Call of Duty, and about 1 million users spent 100% of their game time
super
on
fans.
Call of Duty. So to be clear, what that means is that some people with PlayStations only played Call of Duty. And by some people, I mean 1 million people.
A and solid amount.
The concern is that because, Microsoft would become an Activision Blizzard, a company that owns Activision Blizzard, that they could potentially make the Sony version of Call of Duty not as good as the Xbox version, or they could even not offer it for sale on PlayStation. That would immediately cost Sony a million players. And then those million players may move over to Xbox. And then think about even the folks that spend 70% of their time, which was a much bigger number, 6 million users. They could also then lose those who would, I give up the other games I can play on PlayStation because at least I could play Call of Duty over on Xbox. That's a reasonable concern. But get this. This is how much money Call of Duty is worth to PlayStation. According to The Verge, who, went through this piece, the document seems to say that PlayStation revenue, thanks to Call of Duty, is $1.5 billion across the US and elsewhere.
Wow.
But get this, that's just for the game alone. If you add accessories, subscriptions, and all of the other stuff that people are paying for, $15.9 billion a year.
Dollars. My goodness.
As The Verge says, it could also say not $15.9 billion, but $13.9 billion.
Oh, that's impressive.
Wrong. That is still
still insane amount. Yeah.
So, yes, if PlayStation lost Call of Duty, that could eat up $13.9 billion of revenue at the least. And even if Activision, Blizzard, Microsoft still offered Sony the ability to play it on the PlayStation, but they chose to not bring out new content for it, or chose to, you know, offer a simple version because it doesn't work with PlayStation's systems, whatever. Mm-hmm. That is a concern. That's a reasonable concern. There's also information about how much money Sony gets off of third-party publishers, and information about what Sony knows about PS5 owners and the other kind of devices that they use. So I'm going to read this part too. The Verge quote, Sony also says around half of PS5 owners also have a Nintendo Switch. The FTC and Microsoft have continually been arguing over whether the Switch is a competitor to the Xbox and the PlayStation 5 during this hearing. And Sony's data is even clearer evidence of the makeup of console ownership in the US. So according to internal surveys, almost half of PlayStation 5 owners in the United States also own a Nintendo Switch, while less than 20% of PlayStation 5 owners in the United States also own an Xbox Series X or S, meaning that the Switch is not really considered in the same scope and vein as the PlayStation 5 and the Xbox Series X or S, which makes sense to me. My partner has a PlayStation 5, and more than a dozen times we've talked about getting a Nintendo Switch. It's not like you'd have one or the other, especially for these folks who are, you know, playing games to this level. So ultimately, this Redaction Light, as you've put it, has potentially, you know, revealed trade secrets, which is unfortunate. And even though Sony has requested that this information be removed, the internet, honey, is permanent. And
totally.
It is written,
and it's not
in
out
ink,
there, right?
And you can redact it as much as you want to, but it's still written in ink.
Once it's out, it's out.
Yeah. So journalists, you know, immediately downloaded this. So even if it got pulled from online, it's still there. I wouldn't be surprised if there's an archive.org somewhere of it. Like, that information is out there. And so that could cost Sony some money. And that's kind of adds, it's almost insult to injury, because Sony is already trying to argue that the Activision Blizzard acquisition is going to cost Sony a lot of money and competition. So for them to then potentially lose value due to this exposure of their internal way of doing things, it's even further damaging.
I feel for whoever was responsible for the redaction.
Me too. And we don't know who it was.
Yeah, we don't know who it was, but oh my goodness. Like, I'm just kind of amazed because of the importance of these things. This is not the first document in the world in a court case that has been redacted incorrectly. Like, why is there not a standard system that makes sure that this doesn't happen? I don't understand.
1,000% this should be standardized.
This is 1,000%
There, even when this has been done in the past, we've seen it where instead of it being that the text can still be read underneath because it's sort of bleeding through, we've seen it where the text is selectable underneath a redaction and then you just copy and paste it elsewhere.
Right.
People,
so weird.
Redactions should not be something that does not result in a redaction.
Yeah. Yeah. I don't understand why. I just don't get it. But also, I mean, you know, not to bring this back around to AI systems and everything like that, but things like this could probably be, you know, even when we think they are redacted accurately, there are possibly clues and stuff that we can't see to the naked eye that a system that's trained on this data could actually possibly pull out as well. Like, this is pretty obvious when you look at the screenshots. And I don't know if there's been any sort of tweaks on contrast or whatever to accentuate what's bleeding through. But my point is, there are ways to make these things a little bit more obvious, you know, to do like inverse color switching and things like that to really kind of pull these things out. And
there's even AI tools, computer vision tools that can get this information.
Exactly.
But you don't have to go that far.
You know, like, I don't understand why a document has to be printed and then redacted from, other than there's probably, you know, you have multiple people involved and pass. I guess what I'm saying is, if I print out a document that has the redaction built into the document, then this wouldn't happen.
Right.
Because it's not printing a layer of something and then a black bar over the top of it.
Well, it depends. It shouldn't do that. But yeah, if you use some tools, it's essentially like in Photoshop, adding a layer on top. And depending on if you're using, again, a laser printer or an inkjet printer, you could still end up seeing the text underneath, depending on how the machine kind of renders that as layered or not.
Right.
So yeah, that's the other thing. It goes back to you talking about doing a standard, because you, no matter what tool you're using, if it's not doing it correctly, meaning that it basically removes what's underneath entirely, you could end up exposing stuff. But I want to know how this was done though, because let's look back, go back to that page. You can see, it looks like someone almost took one of those little template things for scrapbooks and laid it down on top of it and colored in.
Yeah.
Because the curves on the edges are so perfect. But yet it does look like some sort of marker did it, unless they've got some sort of like rolling tool. I don't know. I just want to know who did it, how they did it. I'm so curious about this.
Super curious.
Is there a standard redaction marker and redaction stencil? That's the word I was looking for. Stencil.
Right.
That they use for this?
Like 2 million PlayStations, the top right one. It's three little segments.
Yeah, they even
that have
do it
the little drips in between
character.
And so, like, if that was a human, if I was redacting that, I'd just go
through
the whole thing. Why would I like leave those perfectly segmented?
Yeah.
You know what I mean? It's just, I don't understand how it's done either. Maybe we're focusing on the wrong thing, but I'm still fascinated by
questions
it.
Questions that need answers, right? Goodness gracious.
It's still a thing that apparently keeps getting, you know, done wrong. And I think from a technology standpoint, there's something to learn from this. Dang it. Do it right. Whatever right is. Whatever that is. All right. Well, we've reached the end of this episode of Tech News Weekly. Thank you so much for watching and listening, as you hopefully do each and every Thursday. twit.tv/TNW is where you go to subscribe. Because if you haven't heard us say before, subscribing is really, really important. We love doing this show. You subscribe to our show, you'll continue getting it. It's as simple as that. So twit.tv/TNW.
And this is the part where I want to mention the club. Yeah, we got a club. It's a lot of fun to join the club. When you join the club at twit.tv/clubtwit, starting at $7 a month or $84 a year, you get some pretty awesome stuff. First and foremost, you get every single Twitch show ad free. That's right. It's just the show, just the content, none of the ads, because you, in effect, are sponsoring the shows by becoming a member of the club. So we, of course, appreciate you for doing that, along with access to every single Twitch show ad-free. You also gain access to the Club Twit Discord and the Twit Plus bonus feed that has extra content you wouldn't find anywhere else. It's behind the scenes, before the show, after the show, special Club Twit events. And that Discord server I mentioned earlier, it's a fun place to go to chat with your fellow Club Twit members and also those of us here at Twit. There are animated images. There are several channels that you can pop into and kind of talk with people about different topics. It's so much fun to hang out there and see the great stuff that people are posting, all starting at $7 a month, $84 a year, twit.tv/clubtwit. When you join the club, you're also going to get some exclusive shows that are only available to club members. There is the Untitled Linux Show. It's a show all about Linux, as you might have guessed.
Without a title.
Without a title, exactly. You also get access to Hands on Windows, which is Paul Thurrott's short format show that covers Windows tips and tricks. My show, Hands on Mac, that covers all things Apple. Also a short format show. The episode that'll publish later today is all about taking the stuff you're storing with Apple and backing it up somewhere else. I got a question from a lecturer who uses iCloud Drive to store their keynote presentations. And was going, how do I put these somewhere else if I want to make sure that they don't get deleted or removed? It was a great question. Super pumped to get to answer that. As well as Home Theater Geeks, which has newly relaunched in the club, featuring Scott Wilkinson. It is all about your home theater, the devices that you use, the setups that you might have. Great show, and upcoming shows too, like we hear one involving artificial intelligence from Jason Howell. If you would like to follow me online, I'm at Micah Sargent on many a social media network, or you can head to chihuahua.coffee. That's chihuahua.coffee, where I've got links to the places I'm most active online. consider watching my shows again later today. If you're a member of Club Twit at twit.tv/clubtwit, Hands on Mac. On Sundays, you can check out Ask the Tech Guys featuring Leo Laporte and yours truly, where we take your tech questions live and do our best to answer those. And then on Tuesdays, where I record iOS Today with Rose Mary Orchard, although this coming Tuesday, it's the 4th of July, so we will not be having an episode. So tune in later. Jason Howell, what about you?
Well, find me at Jason Howell on Twitter, twit.social/@Jason Howell on Mastodon. That Jason Howell on TikTok. I'm having some fun on TikTok right now, actually. So you could go there as well if you like. Trying to kind of up my ante on a little bit of social media involvement, because I've been taking such a breather and a break for a while. So I'm a little bit more active right now, in other words. Well, right now it's TNW for me. All About Android is yeah, there it is. A bunch of pictures of me talking to a camera in my car is most of the time.
Oh, neat.
And a dog that I think we're getting a Bernedoodle, so I'm excited about that. See, really, it's just the important stuff that you'll find on my channel.
Exactly.
I am working on an artificial intelligence show, and you know, more news to come on that. But I would just say, if you're interested in that, you know, and you've got ideas, suggestions, anything really, Jason@twit.tv. There you go. I don't have a website to point you to yet, but Jason@twit.tv, you can send me your feedback on that. But big thanks to everybody here in the studio helping us do this show. Both of the Johns, there was Burke outside the door. Ant was in here earlier working on the cameras. And thanks to you. That's right. You at home watching and listening. We appreciate you. And we'll see you next time on Tech News Weekly. Bye, everybody.
Hey, I'm Rod Pyle, editor-in-chief of Ad Astra Magazine, and each week I join with my co-host to bring you This Week in Space, the latest and greatest news from the final frontier. We talk to NASA chiefs, space scientists, engineers, educators, and artists, and sometimes we just shoot the breeze over what's hot and what's not in space books and TV. And we do it all for you, our fellow true believers. So whether you're an armchair adventurer or waiting for your turn to grab a slot in Elon's Mars rocket, join us on This Week in Space and be part of the greatest adventure of all time.